listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, WPR has a new show to share with you, and starting tomorrow, you'll hear it every Saturday. We'll learn more about Beta from the show's creator. First, it's time for our weekly review of state news. A new report details payments the state made to settle sexual harassment claims over the last decade. There's a lot going on in local politics this week, including one of the state's youngest mayors being elected, and a state representative is defending his choice to remove a protest sign from the Capitol building. Robert Mentzer is a statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Wausau. Rob, welcome back.
Hey, Rob. Thank you.
Let's start with these sexual harassment settlements. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel obtained documents through an open records request that shed some light on the last decade's sexual harassment payouts from the state. What did we find out?
Sure. So, I mean, the short version is that the state has paid nearly $800,000 in settlements on a dozen different claims of sexual harassment and related cases. This is actually not all that the state has paid. This is the amount that has come through a specific Bureau of Risk Management. There are some other cases where, like, individual state agencies paid out settlements, but this gets, you know, it gets to be it is a lot of money. It is a lot of taxpayer money going to settle claims or allegations of bad behavior in places like state prisons, the University of Wisconsin system, and the state legislature itself.
And how big are the individual settlements as they add up here?
So they of course they vary, but I mean, I think we're looking at some that are in the sort of tens of thousands. One of the larger ones was involved the former state senator and now Milwaukee City Treasurer Spencer Coggs, who paid the office paid $75,000 to settle a sexual harassment and racial discrimination claim.
And do we have a sense of the scope of the ones that weren't included in claims paid out by the Office of Risk Management? How much more might be out there?
You know, it is hard to know. That's sort of the nature of it. What happened was so these records were released and in response to requests by the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and the Wisconsin State Journal. And in the wake of the release, both papers identified individual cases that they had reported on of settlements that came from the state that were not included in the records release. Because of the nature of how these settlements are made, the technical nature of how they're referred, it would seem that the majority do go through the Bureau of Risk Management, because it's only under certain specific conditions that that the individual agencies would settle. But, like, we don't know what we don't know, you know?
And there's a lot more attention to this and maybe a lot more scrutiny in the aftermath of the Me Too movement, right?
For sure. No, I mean, that absolutely triggered these news organizations to look into this at all. There was also a records fight where, the state didn't want to release some records on the grounds that it could expose identities of victims. There's a cost to that, but these are taxpayer dollars that are being paid to settle sexual harassment, sexual misconduct at public agencies. So, I mean, that's the argument, is that ultimately there's a public interest in letting people know what is being done with their money arguably to protect people who have behaved wrongly.
Talking to Rob Mentzer from USA Today Network Wisconsin in our weekly roundup of Wisconsin news. Election day this last week, Rob, a lot of the attention went to the state Supreme Court, but there were a lot of local races happening as well, some maybe of statewide interest. Want to check out a few of them. First, Guy Zima, a longtime Green Bay alderman, lost his seat on the city council. He has been in the state news on and off over the years. Talk about this race.
Sure. Guy Zima is a larger-than-life figure in Green Bay. He's been a part of the city council since 1976, though I guess he was voted off in 2012 for a couple years and then came back. But he's legendary in the city of Green Bay, and his losing his race was the cause. I talked to reporter John Anderson at the Green Bay Press Gazette and said that he was hearing from people from, like, Hawaii or all over the place who had grown up in Green Bay who were amazed. Zemma is like he's a volatile figure. What he's known for is he flies off the handle a lot. He's had a string of complaints against him at Green Bay City Hall, allegations that he screamed at city employees or threatened them. More recently, there was this ethics investigation, and apparently, finally, his behavior caught up to him with voters.
And then in Wausau, Mary Tao was elected to the city council for the first time. What made that race stand out to you?
Well, so Mary Tao is a Hmong woman, and it's not the first time that that Wausau has elected a Hmong woman, but this particular race is really compelling. There's a controversy in Wausau a couple years ago when there was a peaceful protest that was attended by a lot of members of the Hmong community, protesting the treatment in the legal system of a Hmong boy who'd been convicted of convicted of a murder he committed when he was 15 years old. So they had a march about this. In the wake of that incident, a city council member named Sherry Abbott had an email exchange with her constituent in which she, Abbott, said that the march was basically like a Ku Klux Klan rally, and that since she wouldn't support the KKK, she also wouldn't support this march. And it was, offensive on its face statement. The constituent that she was corresponding with was Mary Tao, who later decided to, maybe she'd like to run for city council. And as it happened, after Mary Tao announced her candidacy, Sherry Abbott said she would not seek re-election. But it happened, and on Tuesday, Tao easily took that seat.
And you also pointed us toward the mayoral race in Merrill, a younger mayor there. Can you talk about Derek Wellner, the mayor-elect of Merrill, Wisconsin?
Sure. So, yeah, he's 25 years old. He beat the 72-year-old incumbent mayor of Merrill, Lincoln County city of about 10,000 people or so. Wellner talked about the importance of bringing people together, listening to the residents. And he also wants to build a frisbee golf course, which is fun.
Yeah, we hear a lot in Wisconsin about smaller communities in the state losing young people or worried about retaining younger people, keeping them from moving away, or maybe even luring younger people to those communities. How do you think Wellner's story fits into that narrative?
For sure. No, for sure. I think that, it would be fair to include Lincoln County and the city of Merrill as among those communities that feel worried about their sort of aging populations and have placed an emphasis on the importance of attracting younger people. And yeah, who knows? I mean, a young mayor maybe can at least attract a little attention. Who knows if if people will pick up and move to the city as a result. But yeah, I think that could be part of his message.
And then I want to move on to this story from the state capitol. State Representative Dale Coinga had some things to say about an incident in May involving a sign in the state capitol building. And speaking of settlements, there was one there. First, Rob, tell us, give us the backstory here.
Yeah, I find this story absolutely wild. So Coyango was found on a surveillance video to have stolen a protest sign that was legally displayed in the Capitol last May, and then he took it and he hid it in his office. Coyango is a conservative Republican. This was an anti-Trump sign that it was permitted to be there. It was political speech in the Capitol, but when the surveillance tapes showed that Coyango had removed it, he ended up signing off on a settlement that is going to cost taxpayers $30,000.
And Coyango weighed in on the incident when asked about it by a constituent this week. Here's what he had to say.
The military, what I do in the military is military intelligence. And when you have something like a sign against a curved wall in a place where it shouldn't be, that is a clear risk. Okay? You just can't leave signs that conceal something in the public.
Has there been reaction to that explanation?
It was a curved wall. It was for the. It was his military training that showed him. I mean, I don't know. Like, so by his story, it is a pure coincidence that the sign he stole and hid happened to be a sign that also represented a political viewpoint he disagreed with. So I don't know. I mean, I think that the response is pretty obvious that if he was concerned about a security risk, he might have considered going to the Capitol Police. It's a lot to swallow to say that it was purely because of his military training, but that is apparently that is the story he's going with.
It's a bit Seinfeld-y as a state capitol story. Rob, thanks a lot for joining us today.
All right, thank you.
That's Rob Metzger, statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin. He's based in Wausau. He joins us about every week for a look at some top state news stories. First, after two successful pilot runs as part of the WPR Next project, we're welcoming on a new weekly Saturday show. It starts tomorrow, and it can be heard at 9 a.m. on our news and classical station or 11 a.m. here on the Ideas Network. Doug Gordon is the host and producer of Beta. You might remember him as a former producer on To the Best of Our Knowledge. Doug, thanks for joining us.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for the invite.
Well, tell people who haven't followed the WPR Next process about Beta. What goes on Beta?
Beta, we like to describe it as kind of a polyphonic mosh pit in which high culture and low culture collide, and there's no serious damage done, and there can't be because our insurance wouldn't cover it. So we look at it's playful. I think the three words that I use to describe it, if I need like a really short elevator pitch, if it's just one floor or an escalator pitch, would be it's playful, provocative, and dare I say it, postmodern, three P's.
A lot of work clearly goes into it from what I've heard,
yes.
But it also sounds like you're having fun.
Yes, we're trying to be, very, very good, Rob. I'm glad you picked up on that. And being the astute interviewer that you are, I'm not surprised. Because that's one of my pet peeves about public radio. So much of it sounds just too serious and formal. Not your show, of course, Central Time sounds. You're doing a great job.
I try to
you're
be as formal as I possibly can.
Oh,
Douglas.
No, you do not, Robert. You do not try to be as formal as you possibly can. But anyway, what I'm getting is we try to have sort of more of an irreverent, playful kind of attitude, especially when a lot of the subjects we're looking at, pretty much all of them, in fact, are arts, entertainment, pop culture related. So if you're talking about things, you know, that are fun, or why can't you have fun with them as well and be a little more playful?
Well, I want to take a listen to, we've got a few clips from the show. Here's one of you talking to Dave Carlson. He's made a new documentary on Joe Frank, a famous radio personality who passed away earlier this year. Here's a listen.
When he passed away in January, you heard a lot of stuff in podcasts, and you saw a lot of writings about him and stuff like that. And because podcasts are like the new thing nowadays, you know, he kind of blows a lot of people away who think they're doing innovative stuff now. I mean, all those types of things and the deep thoughts he put into his shows, and he did it on a weekly basis when he was doing his thing. I mean, it's amazing the amount of content he put out and how rigorous he was with his shows. I mean, they would literally be stringing them up minutes before they were being played live, so to speak. So his work ethic can't be beat.
So we're gonna learn a thing or two about maybe some of the origins of our modern pop culture.
Absolutely, yeah. Joe Frank is a guy who I wasn't overly familiar with. Years ago, when I was working on Michael Feldman's What Do You Know, somebody mentioned, hey, can you get me copies of Joe Frank's work? And that was the first I'd heard of him. I don't know. I'm curious, Rob. Had you ever heard of him?
I am not familiar with him.
Yeah,
no.
And he's really, yeah, that's the whole thing that Dave says during the interview and that the case is made for in the documentary is that there are two kinds of people in the world, those who have heard of Joe Frank and those who haven't. So, yeah.
Now, a tricky thing for me in doing stuff on pop culture is there's so much of it. There's no way one human, I mean, I talk to, and you do too, professionals, people who work on pop culture stuff for a living. There's no way they can keep up with it. There's so much. So how do you consume it yourself, pop culture, and try to keep tabs even if it's the stuff you're not currently watching or reading?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I mean, you can't, you kind of have to, yeah, it's tough with
it's like triage.
Yeah, it's triage. It's really hard to keep track of, Rob. You can only do so much, you know, look at the web and things and read a lot and things, but you can't immerse yourself, I mean, in all of it. There's no way to experience it because there's just so much, especially with the internet, the digital age, there's just so much pop culture. And that's funny because that raises a point, well, not funny, but that raises a point about the fact that when we do pop culture, we're also on Beta, we're trying to take a unique angle on it. For example, in the show tomorrow, this series premiere, we do a piece on Breaking Bad because it's been 10 years since Breaking Bad. debut. Doesn't
wow.
It only seems
that
like a decade.
Seem possible.
I know, but it is. But anyway, so we found a kind of a unique lens to look at it through, the Narco Corrido, which is a drug smuggling ballad. Ballads mm-hmm. about drug smugglers. And there's an episode from season two, I think, that has a cold open, which is a music video of a Narco Corrido about Walter White, Bryan Cranston's character, also known as Heisenberg. So we took that and we did this interview with Cordelia Barrera, and she'd written this essay about looking at Breaking Bad and the American Dream through the lens of the Narco Corrido.
Wow. That sounds really interesting.
Now, it is.
How do you, there is so much pop culture and science out there. What is a beta type of story? What kind of angle? How do you know when you see something and you start sniffing and think, oh, this could be our thing?
Exactly. That's a good question. With Joe Frank, that was an obvious, because this is someone, he's public radio, a public radio legend, somebody who's trying to do something different and be super creative, which is something we're trying to do on Beta. And the fact that so many people don't know who he is interesting. And just his work is so, he really did, as Grace Zabriskie says in the documentary, he forged his own genre. He did. And that's part of the reason.
That's why
he
was stood out to you.
Yeah, and also that's one of the reasons why he's not better known. He was too innovative.
Huh. Talking to Doug Gordon, who is just innovative enough, not too innovative.
The precise, yeah, I wish. And maybe, right, well, I'd like to think I'm just innovative enough, but that's...
He's the creator debatable. Of the new show Beta. It's going to start airing tomorrow here on the Ideas Network. Why don't you give a listen to another a bit here from the show. An experimental musician, Amy Denio, am I saying
Denio
that
right? Denio runs with Ohio.
Rami
Denio is probably is nice, though. I like that, but it's Denio runs with Ohio.
Amy Denio, an experimental musician, talking about the ordinary places she gets her inspiration from.
Pretty much everything. I mean, I love noise. I love just sounds you find in the environment. I do a lot of field recording.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, on the Laborazione, it actually starts, there are these two very sad dogs down the street, and they sing in harmony. They actually wail. I don't think they're very happy.
Oh, dear.
I guess they're huskies. I thought they were hound dogs. They were doing their thing, and I thought, oh, I have to record them. It's just the most mournful sound. And then it turned out that they were singing in tune with my brach. So I said, oh, I have to use it on the song. That's great.
Yeah, that's pretty unique. I mean,
Yes, very much so.
A harmonic dog singing along.
Yes, exactly. In key. Yeah, you're not getting pitchy dogs. You know, there's Randy Jackson. That would not apply there. Yeah. So, yeah, that's good. And that was a Steve Gotcher find. I was not familiar with Amy Denio's music, but Steve has been a big fan for years, and he recommended her. And Steve is an integral part, however you want to pronounce it here.
I avoid the word for that reason.
From now on, I will avoid it. Never will I utter integral or integral again. That Steve is really good at the sound design of the show, and also he selects all the music because he has such an encyclopedic knowledge of music.
I wanted to talk about the sound design because part of the innovation, part of the fun, I think, of the show is how you use sound. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, well, I try to sound as someone when the second pilot aired, some listener commented, he sounds in a critical way. Doug Gordon sounds like he's talking to 9-year-olds. So I guess we should be doing Beta for kids, and maybe that's where we'll be. But I just try to be just loose, you know, I mean, in some way, like the kind of way you do is loose, use humor where appropriate, and just have a free flowing, try and be spontaneous and. Be spontaneous, but don't spontaneously combust.
Right, but some audio mixed in there too.
Yeah,
I mean,
some
the music
audio
obviously.
Yeah, and that's Gotcher's department. He's doing a great job on that. And Adam Friedrich, our executive producer, is very helpful. It was his idea to do Breaking Bad through the Narco Corrido, and then I found the guest, and so it was a real team effort.
So this show airs tomorrow. What are a couple of the things we're going to hear on this? We have heard the pilots. This is the official debut. What are a couple of the other things we'll hear tomorrow?
Okay, we'll hear the Amy Denio, the Joe Frank, Dave Carlson, his interview with about the documentary made about Joe Frank. And the third piece in the show is, we mentioned Narco Corridos. We mentioned Amy Denio. Oh, the Narco Corrido.
Narco Corrido, okay.
Yeah, Breaking Bad.
Right.
Breaking Bad through the lens of the Narco Corrido with Cordelia Barrera.
And the fun thing about your show is that the show airing tomorrow is actually the past for you, right? Because you're already working on, this is a weekly gig now.
Yes.
Your brain is on the future shows.
Yes, we've already put to bed the second show. Now we're working on the third episode. And hopefully we'll get to do a few more after that.
Can you give us a couple tastes of things to come, a couple of quick promos for what we're going to be hearing over the next few weeks?
Sure. Over the next few weeks, we have a phone booth interview with a woman named Arianna Kelly, who wrote a small book about phone booths.
And for our younger listeners, phone booths are places you can go and put in change and make a phone call.
And we went to the phone booth at the Party City at Prairie Town Center. There is an actual working phone booth there. And we did the interview. You got to do a phone booth interview from a phone booth.
So you were both in the same phone booth?
No, she was in Los Angeles. She was in a studio.
Okay, but you recorded it from a phone booth.
That's right. Well, you got to. That's what Beta does. Beta does things differently, playful, provocative, and postmodern.
Okay, a phone booth interview. And is there anything you're hunting for now? You're like, this is the thing I want to do, and I'm trying to, I've got my bloodhounds on the march trying to find just the right guest for it.
That's a good question.
Yeah, I didn't tell you I was going to ask you that.
No, you didn't. And
that's the kind of hard-hitting interview you're going to get.
Exactly. I want to do something about the secret history of driveway moments, but I'm not sure how exactly I want to do it. Like maybe the origin story of what the first driveway moment is.
The first time somebody
said... And do it from a driveway, of course. We'll record it at a driveway.
But it's got to be so compelling that if I hear that in my driveway...
Yeah, you'll
stay
and listen.
I have to keep listening.
Yeah, exactly. And so we should make it super long. It would be like a really long driveway moment, maybe a whole hour.
Or
like,
two.
Yeah, exactly. Two-parters next week on Driveway Moment Part 2.
Doug, thanks a lot, and best of luck with the show.
Oh, we're going to need it. Thanks so much, Rob.
That's Doug Gordon, host and producer of Beta, a new WPR show launching tomorrow. You can hear it every Saturday at 9 a.m. on the News and Classical station or 11 a.m. here on the Ideas Network, anytime also at WPR.org. Now, the Trump administration recently announced that the 2020 census will ask American households to report their citizenship status. It would be the first time the question went out to all households in the country since 1950. It comes at the request of the Department of Justice, which says they want a better count of eligible voters. Advocates say they think the move could scare off immigrants who fear deportation and worry that their information would be shared with other agencies. Here's White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders addressing those concerns at the White House briefing last week.
This is a question that's been included in every census since 1965, with the exception of 2010, when it was removed. We've contained this question that's provided data that's necessary for the Department of Justice to protect voters and specifically to help us better comply with the Voting Rights Act.
Now, 17 states are suing the Trump administration over the change. Javier Becerra is the Attorney General of California. Here he is announcing the lawsuit.
In our lawsuit, we argue that this decision by the Trump administration violates the Constitution and federal law. First, the Constitution requires, as I said before, the actual enumeration of all people in every state every 10 years. By including a citizenship question, which will diminish response rates, the census will not be able to fulfill its constitutional duty to count everyone.
Our next guest says the problem could be bigger than that and might actually end up affecting red states as well as blue states. Robert Shapiro is chairman of the economic advisory firm Sonicon. He was undersecretary of commerce during the Clinton administration, where he oversaw the 2000 census. Robert, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Before we get into your concerns about this citizenship question, I want to talk about the history of the use of that question in the census. We hear kind of two different dates. Hasn't been in since 1950. And it's been used every time except once, but that's two different parts of the census. Can you break that down?
Certainly. The fact is that for the decennial census, where the forms go to every address in the country, the last time it was used was 1950. That's almost 70 years ago. It has been a question in what's called the short form. The short form was a form which went to about 3 million people rather than 120 million households until through the year 2000. By 2010, another survey had taken its place. But the short form, which asked lots and lots of questions about your housing, about your employment, about your income. That was a very limited survey. The fact is that the broad census, the one mandated in the Constitution, has not included that question since 1950. we shouldn't be surprised that Sarah Sanders has gotten this wrong. She gets a lot of things wrong.
What is your concern about asking the question about citizenship status on the big show, the main census form?
Right. The fact of the matter is, under the Constitution, under every interpretation of the provision of Article 1, Section 2, where the census is mandated in the Constitution, the census is supposed to cover all people located in the United States on April 1st of the beginning of each decade. And there's never been a distinction for those people who are citizens and those people who are not, for those people who are citizens and legal residents and those who are undocumented. And the reason is that the laws which are passed by the Congress and the funds that are distributed based on the distribution of population across states, across counties, they affect everyone, not simply those who have citizenship. And so it's always been the case that it's covered everyone. But there's a second concern here, and that is because the census is so important for allocating seats in the Congress among the states, for distributing funds, and it provides the basis for later surveys which help every department of government carry out their programs more efficiently. It's very important that you get as complete a count as possible, that you not discourage certain groups from participating. And that's why the law also says that the identifiers, the names and addresses of people, cannot be shared with anyone, including any law enforcement officials. This really denies the administration's argument any basis at all. When Wilbur Ross, the Commerce Secretary, announced this, and Sanders alluded to this in the comment you ran, he said he was doing it at the behest of the Department of Justice and Attorney General Jeff Sessions to help enforce the Voting Rights Act, apart from whether anyone believes that this administration wants to enforce the Voting Rights Act. The fact is that that position ties the census to law enforcement, even though the law forbids that. And that means that anyone who has any qualms about the government, about law enforcement, knowing exactly where they are, would have a good incentive to not answer. And that includes not only undocumented immigrants, but many other people, which we can talk about in a moment. But the point is, this hurts everyone. The fact is that, think of $800 billion a year in federal funding is tied, at least in part, to population data collected by the census. So if 2% or 3% of the people in your congressional district or your state decide they're going to avoid answering the census, that hurts everyone in that district, everyone in that state. So this is not simply a matter of affecting those people who don't answer. It affects everyone.
But does it necessarily follow that this will depress turnout? People will be asked about their citizenship status. They'll still get counted in that total you mentioned, and their individual information, as I understand it, still would not be shared. Their name and status wouldn't directly be shared with law enforcement. So what's the problem? Why is that necessarily going to lead to a lower response rate?
Well, the problem is that most people are not very familiar with Title 13, Sections 9 and 214 of the federal code, which protects that information. And so that if people think it might be shared based on the position the administration has taken, there's a lot of people are going to be very cautious. Now, that certainly starts with undocumented immigrants who the administration has made a point repeatedly, again and again and again, that the administration wants to deport them. So why would they, if they think there's any chance that the information might find its way to the Immigration and Naturalization Service, which after all is part of the Justice Department, why would they answer the census? Now, that affects not only their numbers, but many undocumented immigrants live in households with citizens or legal residents. And so it discourages the entire household from answering the census. If everyone were an expert in the federal law and in Title 13, I wouldn't be concerned. That's obviously not the case.
We're talking to Robert Shapiro. He was the Undersecretary of Commerce during the Clinton administration, where he oversaw the 2000 census. He's with us to talk about the Trump administration's move to add a question about citizenship to the 2020 census. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Should we be asking about citizenship status on the census? What do you want to know about how the information will be used? What questions do you have about how all of this works? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about a question on citizenship status being included in the 2020 census. I should say. Robert Shapiro is with us. He oversaw the 2000 census as Undersecretary of Commerce. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about asking about citizenship status on the census? Do you think it's a good idea or not? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Robert, you wrote a recent piece saying this could affect a lot of states, not just the obvious states. It could end up affecting and hurting a lot of Republican-leaning states. Talk about that.
Certainly. As we said, $800 billion in federal funding is distributed to the states based at least in part on population and other information collected by the census. It turns out that most of that funding involves programs for low-income Americans. There is highway construction, which affects everyone. In addition, there is Medicaid and school lunches and Section 8 housing and energy assistance. The preponderance, about two-thirds of that money, is distributed to states based on the number of poor people they have. So in order to see what states would be affected, since all states would be affected to some degree, so what you have to do is look at, with respect to the funding of these programs, which states have above-average poverty rates. And those are the states which would bear the burden with respect to the distribution of funds. And it turns out that 16 states and the District of Columbia have poverty rates that are above average if we look at the years 2014 to 2016. And it turns out that of those 16 states plus D.C., the only blue states are California and New Mexico, plus the District of Columbia. The other 14 states are solidly red states, and they're led by Mississippi and Louisiana and Kentucky and West Virginia and Georgia and Alabama and Arkansas. So it would turn out that the largest cuts, which would arise out of undercounting people, and after all, there are undocumented immigrants in every state. But in addition, there are lots of other people besides undocumented immigrants who would likely be affected. It turns out that that red states are going to bear most of the burden. Even if we look just at the issue of representation and look at just the issue of undocumented immigrants, it's true that that affects quite a number of blue states. It also affects some red states.
I want to bring in a caller, Robert, before we run out of time. Jim is with us in Maquonago. Jim, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
I just wanted to, you know, listening to the caller, or just listening to your guest, he's made a big point about the funding that's all tied to that. I guess I'm looking at it, and he alluded to that, with representation. If we, you know, aren't doing this, isn't there the same problem with being unrepresented, or my vote being watered down because more undocumented workers, undocumented immigrants would be counted in states where their population is higher? And
Jim, I got it. So, Robert, why would we want to count people who are undocumented or otherwise can't vote as we're assigning representation in Congress, just briefly as we're running out of time?
Well, because the Constitution and the Supreme Court has held that representation, the distribution of members of the House of Representatives among the states, should be based on the number of people in each state, as the Constitution says, not the number of citizens, not the number of legal residents. But, you know, there's another issue which we haven't gotten to, and that is the undocumented immigrants are not the only group that might have pause about answering the census if they feel that the information might be shared with law enforcement. For example, there are 22 million Americans who have student loans today. 43% of those people are behind. They're either in default or they're very behind in their payments. That's almost 9.5 million young Americans. Some of them are going to say, well, if this is going to be shared across the administration, I think I'll discretion is the better part of valor. And I'm not going to answer the census. And again, that affects not only them, but often everyone in their household. The same thing is true of parents who are behind in child support.
And we'll have to leave it there. Thanks to Robert Shapiro for joining us today, chairman of the economic advisory firm Sonicon. He's was Undersecretary of Commerce in the Clinton administration, where he oversaw the 2000 census. We've been talking about the Trump administration adding a question about citizenship to the 2020 census. This election season, Wisconsin Public Radio is going beyond the ballot, asking people what issues are important to them, and we're meeting them where they are out in the community. As Bridget Bowden reports, some voters are concerned about how agriculture affects the safety of the drinking water that comes out of their wells.
There are about 900,000 private wells in Wisconsin. People rely on the water for drinking, cooking, and bathing, and some of them are worried. Like Chris Bersian, who lives in Broadhead. He says he worries about his well getting contaminated with bacteria from manure from nearby farms.
The thought of that leaching into the groundwater and, poisoning our well is kind of scary.
There are a few ways that this could happen. Manure is often stored in large lagoons or spread over farm fields as fertilizer. Depending on the depth of the soil and the time of year, it can potentially leach down into the groundwater.
Yeah, it has the potential to really hurt. If our well gets contaminated, then what are we going to do?
He's worried that he may one day have to buy water for his family to use.
But not only that, but it will ruin the property value. It's just kind of a bad situation all the way around.
Some people, like Bersian, are worried about very large farms. Farms with more than 1,000 animal units have to have permits to operate in the state. They're known as concentrated animal feeding operations, or CAFOs. Becky Larson is a professor of biological systems engineering at UW-Madison and UW-Extension. She says the biggest misconception is that only large farms are dangerous for drinking water.
Personally, I think I disagree with that message and that it is not a size that is to blame, it's a management practice.
She says one of the best things people can do is pay attention to what their local governments are doing.
If a farm is large for a permitting process, there are public hearings that go on that you can attend to voice your concerns. Past that, it is difficult to influence whether or not a farm can locate in a certain area.
Larson says some parts of the state are especially vulnerable to well contamination, like some parts of eastern Wisconsin in areas where the soil is very shallow. In January, the State Department of Natural Resources approved restrictions on manure spreading in 15 counties in eastern Wisconsin. The plan needs to be approved by Governor Walker and then will head to lawmakers. Larson says people who are worried about their own water should go to public meetings and voice their concerns.
So people's concerns are very valid, and anything concerning your own resources and your land and where you live and your health is absolutely of a concern.
Janet McConaughey is worried about the 6 dairy and beef CAFOs in Jefferson County where she lives. So she started volunteering, testing water in the area. And then she went one step further. She decided to run for office for a spot on the town board in Ixonia.
My representative on the county board said, well, why don't you just run? So only takes 20 signatures to get on the ballot. And here I am.
She says she ran with her 5-year-old grandson in mind.
What I'm concerned about is Jordan's world. So I want to know that when he's grown up, he'll have a decent place to live. He'll have clean air, clean water.
In the end, McConaughey lost her race for town board. Both seats were won by incumbents. But she says she'll continue to do everything she can to protect the groundwater in her town. Bridget Bowden, Wisconsin Public Radio.
For more stories like this one, visit WPR.org/ballot. To share your own story, call our hotline at 877-782-8942. Coming up Monday on Central Time, health insurance coverage is at an all-time high in the U.S., but costs and other factors are still leading some people to go without. Our guest shares the stories of people without health insurance. And a guest makes the case that the internet was great for comedy until it wasn't. We'll look at the rise and fall of online comedy. That and more coming up Monday here on Central Time.